This is Ryan Hill, Manager of Interpretive Programs and Curatorial Research Associate for the Hirshhorn Museum, and I'm speaking to Curator Ann Elgood today about her exhibit, The Uncertainty of Objects and Ideas. We'll be discussing a few of the objects in this exhibit.
The way that I tend to like to work is to start with the artwork, but I think there are more than two, but two general ways to approach curatorial practice, where you start with, you know, an idea and you go looking for artists, or you start more with the art. So I knew I wanted to do a show about sculpture, and that was from just a very, you know, personal preoccupation with it and wanting to explore that more, thinking, well, what is it about sculpture that I feel is very provocative to me right now? What is it that the sculptural work has to do? But the list of artists that I was interested in, more generally speaking, was rather large.
Right.
So then I started thinking about which of the artists on that larger list was I really, you know, almost obsessed with on some level. And then once I started looking at their work more closely, I started to see those connections. You know, say between Issa, who is a really great starting point for the show, as is Charles Long. Those were two artists who, you know, for Charles, because he'd been making work that was quite different, when I saw this newer work that he's been making the last four years or so, I was really struck by it, and it just stuck with me. And on Issa also, when I saw her work at David's Werner, I just was really moved by it, and I started to just think about what it was that these artists were doing that I felt was shared, and then, you know, really started to get more at the concept of the show that way. And I knew I wanted to keep the exhibition to a relatively small number of artists. That was very important to me, and I think when you do a group show, part of the challenge and the opportunity is to not only endeavor to put some artists together, but to actually think critically about group shows and how they can work better and how they can have particular problems. So I like the format of keeping the number of artists relatively small and presenting each artist in a fairly substantial way, because I think that it allows viewers to understand any individual artist's work in a much more complicated way, and also, so in a way, you know, it's better for the artist, it presents them better, but it also, I think, if you have too many artists around an idea, it tends to make the works feel slightly illustrative of a concept, rather than the notion that the work, that the idea in the show is really coming out of the work. I think with this amount of work, you can make that argument. You can visually make that argument.
No, I think that really does work, because they're all really diverse and they still have their uniqueness. But then something about the materials, or something about, there's a thread that seems to all connect them. So it also, I think that's what's interesting, is this idea of uncertainty comes up, because you feel this connection, you can't explain what it is because they're all so diverse. So it's a really interesting thing. It's interesting how that works.
Yeah, it's a funny concept to start a show with, isn't it? Uncertainty.
Yeah, but I also think that it's daring, because to say it's okay to be uncertain when you look at the work is an invitation to say that these people are exploring something and you can explore it with them. And I think, especially with contemporary work, to say we're certain about what's happening right now is really, you can't.
You have no retrospective view. And also, I mean, the way I think of uncertainty in the exhibition, there are different ways that I think it functions, but two important ones are that something you just touched upon, which is that there are many interpretations available to the works. Even any given element in a piece, we're staring at Issa Genskin right now, and you see this turtle. Well, the turtle can be, you know, many different things to many different people. So right away, you start to bring in your own associations and to connect those to other elements in the piece. And I think that these artists very deliberately keep their work open in that way. So the uncertainty has to do with denying the certainty of a single meaning or a single interpretation. But I also think that uncertainty reflects a kind of cultural zeitgeist, or a sense that we have, I think, as a culture and as a world right now, mm-hmm. that our world does feel very uncertain in many ways. There's a lot of awareness of how in flux things are just naturally, which I think is reflected in the work very much, but also that this is a particularly strife political moment.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the certainties that we thought about the world for different periods of our history that are kind of right. upended right now and questioned. So I think what creates a platform, and you used the word dialogue, and
yeah.
that's a really great word, because I think all of this work encourages dialogue and
right.
even debate.
Right.
And I think that as an institution, that's part of our role,
right.
is to be a platform for that kind of dialogue to happen.
Uh-huh.
Not only when we organize public programs and we sit around and talk about the work,
right.
but also the experience that we can encourage where a person stands in front of an artwork and even has an internal dialogue,
right.
Right. or talks to their friend or whoever they're here with.
And I think that's the hardest thing for people, because I work with the visitor a lot, and one of the things that I notice is that people will often, they still have a little bit of, I think some people, I'm not saying all, but some people will often have the feeling that culture is kind of like medicine. They're supposed to just like take it and not question it.
Mm.
And I think the idea is that that no, you can not only question it, but that your meaning can be on an equal par to other meanings.
Yeah.
But as a curator, I mean, that's a hard position to be in, because in some ways you're still having to, you have a certain amount of professionalism in your field, right? So you have to kind of say, well, I am certain about some things.
Well, it's been interesting, the kind of interpretive process with
yeah.
this work, because I've described this before, that in writing the catalog text, I had these funny moments of, I've described them as sort of existential angst, which is far too strong, but
yeah.
it gives you kind of the sense of it, which was in writing down and putting into words, which of course is limited anyway.
Yeah.
Words never seem to quite be able to express adequately the visual, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not only the visual, but the emotion of this work.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I was writing my catalog, there were moments when I thought, I can't do this. I can't put this down in writing and have it as this, kind of finalized interpretation of this work. And I felt somehow like I was doing an injustice to the work on some level. On the other hand, it's really fun to talk about,
mm-hmm.
and it's really fun to write about. And I think hopefully what comes across in the writing is the very fact that, I have even multiple interpretations mm-hmm. of every artist, and that they're more much beyond that. I mean, Issa is a good example of something where you walk up and you go, oh, okay, well, I recognize stuff.
Right.
There's a landscape reference, there's flowers, there's a turtle, there's a ladder. And immediately you're given things to work with, a doll, a figurine.
And and at least when I look at it, I think, oh, it's so pretty,
Yeah, the
and
colors
and the
are
colors,
really seductive. But then you start to think, but wait,
yeah.
I'm being given all these recognizable things, these objects I may even have in my home. They're certainly,
mm-hmm.
Domestic in some essence. But then what is it, the question of what does it mean? What is she saying? Why is she doing this? What's the relationship between these things?
And there's a figurine here that
who's
seems
beheaded.
To have lost its head and that seems to be having these kind of, those look like air traffic signals to me.
He's
got how they signal planes in?
with his little plastic lollipop?
Yeah.
yeah, it starts to get weirder and harder to interpret and a little bit, the beauty and the color of it becomes complicated by the fact that some of the gestures are a little bit violent.
Mm-hmm.
The splattering of the paint, often many of the objects in Issa's works are not upright. They're
right.
often upended in some way
mm-hmm.
or put on their head. And yet they're all contained on the top of this pedestal.
Yeah.
So there's a really nice balance in this work and several others between these very formal, articulated pieces in which those formal considerations that happened in making are very apparent, and yet there seems to also be a level of spontaneity and a kind of unconscious place that the artist can go to.
And I think the color, too, is interesting. For me, the color seems to be, I seem to think of signals and caution.
Yeah, a lot of bright red and orange. The silver is something she's been using a lot, and I love it.
It's kind of, for me, the association I have with silver is that it can be something that could be made expensive.
Exactly.
Silver, but it's also kind of toxic. Like, you know.
Like the metallic.
Like mercury or lead.
Like you're not supposed to touch it.
Right.
Well, and also with these figures, and the one we're looking at now, it's two elephants, which I love this piece because I have a thing about elephants.
She's
I adore them.
She's got elephants in some of the other ones, too.
Yeah, actually the one we acquired has a little ceramic elephant, the untitled one.
Yeah.
But, I think the silver surface on these as figurines suggests something precious in a way, but then you realize it's really just a surface treatment, and it's painted in a way that leaves a bit of dripping. It's kind of incomplete, not very carefully done, and then there's some black spray paint at the bottom, and so that preciousness gets undermined by other decisions that she's made.
And the extra questions that come up from visitors are things along the line of that come up with a couple of them, which is, how planned are these, and how fast is she working? Because I think people want to figure out, because there is an enormous amount of spontaneity, and there's a sense of a kind of upheaval, which is, I think she's really prolific, right?
She's very prolific, yeah.
So I think there's a sense of that.
There's a
stream,
they like have
a
that
work
feeling
stream
looking
that she
at it.
Continuously produces
Interesting,
from.
Interesting, yeah.
But I'm wondering, but people do want to know about that, because I think it assures them somehow.
Well, you know, I couldn't tell you how long any individual piece takes, because I don't know the answer to that, but...
Are there sketches and plans, or is it just really kind of
I've never
through?
Seen sketches.
Uh-huh.
She works in groups, and she works a lot. She spends a lot of time in the studio, and I think when she's in the studio, my sense is that she's very... almost obsessed. She's in there all the time, and she's working on a group of sculptures. I don't know whether she kind of works on one, finishes it, and moves on to the next one. My assumption would be that she's working on them on multiple pieces at once. And I think when you know which pieces are these first two, and then that that fourth one are from the same moment, I think you start to see certain formal decisions and subject matter that exist in all of them. So I think there's quite a bit of back and forth and a dialogue happening for her. Like on this one, the use of the photograph in the back, which seems to be a setup of objects that are then mimicked in the piece itself, sculpturally, that she's set up in the studio or something, and then taken a photograph of it, blown that up, used it as a backdrop on the screen element, and then ripped into it. On the other one, it's a photo of her studio that she's dripped with paint and then wrapped around the pedestal to act as to become part of the pedestal. And so that photography, using photography in the work, exists in both of these. And I think that relationship of the two-dimensional onto the three-dimensional is something that she's done, you know, in other works too, and is something that she's interested in.
For me, it creates like this theatrical quality, because it's almost like a backdrop that allows you a setting for her characters a little bit.
Yeah.
And the one we were looking at the beginning has kind of a still life quality, but these seem to be, they hint at being narrative, but at the same time they let you know, like, she rips the photographs or she's dripping things or she pastes them together, so they let you know it's, you know, you're not really there. It's just, you know, an illusion. So
yeah,
it's a
this
very,
has a very an illusionary aspect. Does her work feel really personal to you?
I don't know. I'm having such strong, of my own strong reactions to it, I can't imagine what's going on with her, but I do see, like, there's children and there's, like, domestic, you know, objects, and I can kind of imagine what that's about, but what it really reminds me of is if there's a crisis, whether there's a crisis, like, in the domestic setting or outside of it, they influence each other.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it makes me think
about. That's a really, really nice.
Yeah. Because I feel like there's, it's like, I either, when I look at these, this is going to sound crazy, but when I look at these, I hear air raid sirens.
That's oh, wow. So they feel urgent in that way.
They feel kind of urgent, uh-huh. like there's some kind of crisis, but then there's all these children doing it. Uh-huh. And so you think, oh, well, maybe they're just playing.
The children are strangely, they're strangely in danger, but somehow powerful.
Yeah. Now, tell me about that. How... Well, this one certainly feels powerful, and this is kind of amazing how there's this weird mirrored thing that happens on this side.
It's so great. So there's this chair that this divides the top of the piece, and then the baby doll is behind it and looking through the screen, and then he's got his hand in a jar, like a sort of vase. The colors on this are so fantastic, too. Doesn't he look... kind of trapped, but also somehow in charge. I mean, even just the gesture of putting the hand in the vase is so good.
I think to me, it's like they've gotten on top of the pedestal, so there is this kind of...
Where they're not supposed to be.
They're not supposed to be on top of the pedestal. And the other thing to me is that they must, they have physical agility, so they're able to balance and do things. So there is that kind of aspect, which is they have the skill of the acrobat or something that you kind of think of as being, strong and amazing. But at the same, and it is so, it's this precariousness. And I actually see that through a lot of the works in here.
Yeah,
it's this precarious
absolutely.
Thing. I guess for me, there is a part of me that kind of wants to figure out what this work is about, because it's like, what are these artists telling us about our own time period?
Mm-hmm.
Or how they're at least feeling in it.
Somehow that precariousness is balanced by the fact that indeed they all do stand upright,
mm-hmm.
that
mm-hmm.
none of this work requires any kind of support in order to stand upright. They don't, mm-hmm. They're not tethered to the floor, they're not, sort of held in place from above.
Mm-hmm.
They really all very deliberately make freestanding objects, and that quality of autonomy is very deliberate and important in the work, and yet there's still this precariousness. So I think making us aware that those two things are kind of part of a whole, and that I think Andrea has said this about her work, Andrea Cohen, that you have this awareness that it could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
The thing could keep growing in a sense. Mm-hmm. You could see more objects piled on top of Issa's works, or you could see it topple over and fall to the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those are real possibilities. And finding that moment of equilibrium that gets presented to us in the form of the sculpture. I think there's also a bit of a play, suggesting this precariousness, but also these are people who make objects in a very conscious and deliberate way.
I was looking at the Franz West, I was thinking...
Do you want to walk down there?
Yeah, but I was thinking, here are two very different approaches to sculpture, which have...
Which somehow go together.
Yeah, they're psychological.
Yeah, very psychological.
But at the same time, two very different ways of approaching it.
Well, I think also the difference between the suggestion of something being... in decay or precarious in scatter art is also... has a different relationship to space and to the gallery.
Mm.
And these artists are also very committed to the notion of creating an independent object, an autonomous object, and that these things go in the gallery.
Right.
They have a relationship to architecture, but it's not the same relationship to architecture that a lot of work that's even described as sculpture now has, that is more installation-oriented, that is more about an immersive environment, that invites the visitor to enter into a space.
Mm-hmm.
This work invites the visitor to exist in the space with it, almost like another body, and it invites the visitor to walk around.
Mm-hmm.
All of this work really can't be understood from one perspective. So, of course, in that way, it's very sculptural. It's different than painting, but it's also... I think it's work that really shifts depending on where you're standing.
Yeah, and with Issa's work, it shifts also, but it shifts for me in a narrative way, and with Franz's work, it is more on a bodily level and not on like I keep saying theater with her work, but.
Well, you know, theatrical is a word that's come up a few times, and I find it really interesting. In part, of course, because, Fried criticized minimalism for its theatricality.
Oh, okay.
But this is obviously far from being minimalism, so it's not the same discussion.
No.
But I think theatrical is a word that has a lot of interesting connotations for people, not only because I think it says something about a quality of narrative,
mm-hmm.
that can exist in sculpture, even formal sculpture and abstract sculpture. We're looking at abstraction, essentially,
mm-hmm.
and thinking of it as having a narrative quality. But also because theatricality suggests a kind of energy, I think,
mm-hmm.
Or psychology, like you
right.
said before, and that's very evident.
And
but
even though they're using everyday, some of these are using everyday objects, there's nothing everyday about them. I feel that one of the things that I'm noticing visitors' involvement is that they are transported.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't say that about all of them. I hate to say that about all of them.
You can generalize.
Generalize.
I understand.
Thank you for generalizing. But I mean, with this work here, I mean, the fact that I can see newspaper is interesting. And for me, it ties again to Issa's work in a funny way because I am having a sense of something that exists that connects me to the outside world again.
Right. But and I think that's really important for Franz.
Yeah.
He wants the work to, in a way, be a part of the everyday,
mm-hmm.
that it's not separate from it, that even though you're in a museum, it conjures up your life and reality. I want to go back to something you said because I was really struck by it, that the different perspectives on Issa makes you think of narrative, but with Franz, it has more to do with the body, right?
Yeah, and I feel like with Rachel's work, too.
Uh-huh.
Like, some of them, I go into a story mode, and other ones, they seem to be kind of having a bodily presence.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes they seem to dissolve, and sometimes they seem to actually be present. That's very weird.
Did Franz's, for you, do you have a sense of both the outer skin of the body and the interior? Like, being somehow made visible, or do you think of it that way? I'm just curious because these objects, I mean, the shift in surface treatment is very interesting.
Uh-huh.
The raw paper mache and then the painted elements, the different kinds of paint that's used.
Yeah.
And the fact that, in fact, they are hollow. So we know they don't have an inside.
Right.
And it's almost like that inside is somehow on the outside.
Yeah, I can see that.
Well,
there's a couple things, because if these are Sisyphus series, it makes me think about that this is something that keeps rolling,
yeah.
and it rolls into stuff. And like a shoe, it picks stuff up off the ground.
Totally,
Or like snowballs. So it's all a little like a snowball. But then what you're saying to me is that this could also be something that it's spit up outside of itself, you know.
Because
the paint has an activated quality too, you know. So I would say, but this one looks more like something that would be stuck to a shoe.
I think I like that description. And, you know, Sisyphus, of course, was the Greek mythological figure who had to push the rock up the hill repeatedly.
Right.
So here, you know, when you look at this, what I love is in the title, Franz is giving us a narrative to start with. And then we have this form that is rock-like on some level. So maybe this is the rock that Sisyphus used.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also so figurative and bodily in some way, or biomorphic, I guess is the best way to describe it. And so then you think, no, what I've got is the actual figure of Sisyphus. And I think just as a story, it's an interesting starting place because I think at least many people associate that myth with a quality of futility, the act of doing over and over again the same thing and kind of ending up in the same place. But I think that Franz thinks of it in a much more positive way, in the sense that artists are always going to make things,
mm-hmm.
and in a way they're always engaged in that same activity, that rolling the stone up the hill,
mm-hmm.
but that in that act of making, there's always something new, there's always something to learn, there's always something interesting that gets revealed literally in the act of doing the physical exertion of it.
And that's what's interesting to me is when you're speaking, I'm thinking that you're talking about the meaning of the work, but we can't separate the meaning of the work from how it's made, and that's fascinating to me. So it's almost as if the way that he shows the accumulation of the materials and the layer of the materials, you get a sense that because it was done over time, that accumulation and that layering is part of its very, like, it's part of the experience of the work.
Absolutely.
Somehow this object has actually has life experience on it, has mm-hmm. gone through all these different layers of being worked on, but it also kind of makes you think, if you identify with it, I guess, you would think that it actually has its own history.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And then it makes you wonder, how does Franz know when this piece is done?
Yeah.
And I feel that way with a lot of the artists, right. You know, that it could be unfinished. It suggests the quality of being unfinished, and that the unfinished is indeed finished. That they're willing to present work that has the possibility of an incompleteness, mm-hmm. to I think underscore that very quality of process that's so visible in the materials. Certainly the way that Franz paints things, you feel like he could still be doing it, still
right.
be working on it. Maybe even another color could be added. And in a way, it's a very generous way to present work, because you almost, as a viewer, feel like you too could add something to it.
Yeah, because,
you know?
For instance, this layer of newspaper could be another layer of paper mache to build the form, and then more paint goes on top of that.
Right.
But he's left that bare. Just
exactly.
kind of like how the palette is used. He uses these palettes, and those palettes were partly, they were his decision to be used, but you had the choice to stack them in certain ways.
Yeah, so what happened was, and Franz has a long history of creating really interesting pedestals for sculpture. And I think with both Issa and Franz, they make a very deliberate choice to still use the pedestal, mm-hmm. which seems to be a nod to modernism on some level, or even more classic sculpture, as the mode of presenting sculpture. But they change it up and do something unusual and very personal and idiosyncratic. So Franz has used things that are actual objects and tend to be things that have a utilitarian mm-hmm. Position. Mm-hmm. So he's done things like made pedestals as cupboards, and guards in the museum were allowed to put their things into them.
Oh, cool.
So they kind of had this double function, as acting as a pedestal and acting as a storing unit for guards' stuff. In this case, it's the palettes. And what happened is that Kiefhus and Kepler, this piece right here, that had actually been exhibited on palettes before.
Uh-huh.
And so when we were talking with Franz about the selection of works and how to present them, he suggested that we use palettes for all of the works to create a kind of visual link between them, even though they come from, except for the two Sisyphus that are from a series,
uh-huh.
Which actually has 10 in total, and we have two here. The other two works, they're all from different times, and they're not necessarily related.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a way to link them. But then he said, you know, you decide how many palettes to stack up and how you want to position them and what angle they're at. But I love that the palette is part of the infrastructure of the museum. It's
right.
the thing that we use to bring the objects into the museum, and then we usually discard them. And they're, you know, they're dirty, and they're for shipping, and they're for movement.
Right. And they're also the part of the museum that the visitor usually doesn't get to see.
Right.
And so they're kind of very humble that way. It's not, you know, they're the thing that's not art, like the crates.
Exactly.
And yet
exactly.
there's someone who makes them, and there's someone who uses them that is part of that process of bringing art into the museum.
Yeah, and it has this wonderful, wonderful suggestion of movement,
mm-hmm.
that we could move the sculptures around if we felt like it.
Yeah.
That they're not, you know, there's the permanence is something that isn't so important. Okay, so this particular Rachel Harrison were looking at Shelley Winter, there's wood in it. It happens to be an IKEA table.
Right.
So that's a little different than what you might expect, but wood is obviously a very common material. Plaster, paper mache, even, you know, metal in some cases. And then a lot of these other unusual materials, those tend to be found objects, in some cases trash or detritus, and in a lot of cases commodities, actual things that you would purchase. So we just talked about that with Issa's work.
Right.
Rachel is a really great example of somebody who incorporates both of those things in every single work on some level. So there's really the sculptural part that is very handmade, at times very elaborate, made with wood, pieces of styrofoam, and scraps of wood sometimes that are covered in a kind of cement, this material that she uses in most of her work, a kind of cement material that becomes a surface that she can make either biomorphic or more architectonic or angular, and then she paints those elements. And then those are juxtaposed to objects.
Right.
So we're looking at pretty discrete.
Right.
And
it's a little bit of the, actually, we can't see the two artists we've been looking at, but it combines those, yeah, it combines found materials.
Yeah, with the sculptural, objects. So this one, I mean, I love this piece. It's so interesting. It's just got a lot going on, and it's got this really elaborate, assembled wooden structure that seems to me to be a reference to David Smith,
yeah,
or other artists who were welding pieces together to create a kind of meandering assembly of different shapes and forms. So Rachel's done it here with scraps from a carpenter's shop that she just literally like pulled out of the dumpster outside of the carpentry house, which is in her neighborhood in Brooklyn. And so that becomes this really elaborate structure upon which these other objects are housed. And one of those objects is this really large sculptural element that's a big pink angular assemblage of things.
Mm-hmm.
And in a funny way, I think of the David Smith wood part as really the apparatus or the display mechanism for the big pink object.
Mm.
And then the two found commodities that she's used, one being this all-star wrestler figure, and then one being a can of country kettle air freshener.
Country kettle. And I'm trying to figure out what that smells like, country kettle.
Oh, God.
Why is it really flowery?
And, you know, on the other side?
What's happening for me, because if you think about David Smith, I think that's just a French...
Yeah, well, I love that it's English
and French.
And French.
And it's on two sides of the...
Uh-huh.
I think she... Yeah, I mean, what to me, when you think about David Smith, you think about, you know, kind of like the working class hero,
mm-hmm.
or person who kind of welds. And
a very American artist.
And very kind of male.
Mm-hmm.
And, very, you know, and I think what she's doing is, like, for me, this pink area, it's very cake frosting to
mm-hmm.
me.
Yeah.
And then also with the wizard, so there's just a real sense of kind of feminizing the
mm-hmm.
work. And I think we had talked about that there are issues about gender in her work too.
Absolutely.
And I think that the humor of it, there's humor that comes in.
A lot of humor, yeah.
I have to say, people, I think when they're in this, visitors in this room, what I've gotten a sense is they understand that there's humor here.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes they don't understand the humor in some of the other works too.
Uh-huh.
And I think if you don't understand the humor, then you take some of it face value, and then it's not irony, but it's just a kind of a pleasure that we, you know, that things can be made and you can have.
Well, that they're serious, that's, but pleasurable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's again, maybe what makes people feel uncertain.
Yeah.
Which is that they think, well, we're in an art museum, and it should be serious, and this is, like, new art, and it's telling us something about ourselves, but, like, is it laughing at us?
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, what's happening here?
Yeah.
So some funny things start to happen, but I think with her work, it kind of comes together so that there is a sense of kind of the surprise, and that surprise makes it like a joke.
Well, the surprise is really fun because it often has to do with a kind of obfuscation of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, in this piece, you may not even notice the can of Country Wizard air freshener. You have to really look for little moments. And in other works, and we've talked about this before,
right.
But like with Cindy,
right.
there's the way in which you walk into the gallery and there's this wall, mm-hmm. and then you have to go around the wall to find the rest of the sculpture on the other side. And you know, when you walk in, you see a little bit of it peeking mm-hmm. up from the top, and it's very alluring. You want to find out what's going on.
It could even be a real person, because you
yeah.
can't really see a face.
Yeah, because of the wing.
And but you're, oh, I just noticed the same green was being used in the signage for
coaching contest. Check it out.
That's
now I know where that color came from. I couldn't figure it out.
No,
we really didn't ever
right.
associate it with sudden, that deliberately.
Yeah.
We just liked it.
This thing is, it's called Cindy, but I've been looking at the name of the wig, which is that it's the Peggy Sue wig.
Yes.
So even the Cindy has an alternate identity as Peggy
yes.
Sue.
Yes. Well, and interestingly, and the reason that, you know it's the Peggy Sue wig is that the label is still left on. And Rachel does that a lot on the commodities that she uses in the work. Usually a label, a price tag, none
right.
of that stuff is removed.
Right.
So it really references that way that, you know, commodities function for us. But the double kind of name mm-hmm. quality, I think, is
yeah.
really important, because one of the Cindy's, and I'm sure there are others, but one that she's referencing here is Cindy Sherman,
mm-hmm.
who indeed herself, her work is based in masquerade.
Right.
So, you know, Cindy dressed up as Peggy Sue or vice versa, you know,
right.
you could go back and forth.
And also, I think by showing the price tag on these things, she's also dealing with class in a funny way.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you come into a gallery or a museum, especially in the art world, it's like you really shouldn't be talking about price.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if it's just yes. artwork, you know.
Especially in a museum.
Yeah,
this is no gallery.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. I mean, just saying generally.
Yeah.
To talk about price and to see that the price is much cheaper than perhaps it's being purchased for.
An important thing is that, of course, it's only the commodities that would have any kind of price
right,
tag on
right.
them. Then there's this whole other aspect of the work, which is the handmade part, the part mm-hmm. that we would consider more, you know, the sculptural creation mm-hmm. of the artist.
Mm-hmm.
And so juxtaposing those together just underscores, of course, the difference between those
mm-hmm.
things, the
mm-hmm.
things that we go out in the world that are reproduced, you know, available widely, are relatively inexpensive,
mm-hmm.
cheap, those getting incorporated into a sculpture.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, with Rachel, there's always this back and forth and kind
right.
of, you know, jumping between things that seem to be at odds with one another,
right.
but somehow in the work get incorporated into something that feels complete and that really has a relationship. I think also, you know, the commodities for Rachel and other artists in the show are very direct references to reality.
Mm-hmm.
So in a way, I would counter what you just said by saying that they are suggesting that the realities of our lives are in fact material that's valuable to include into art.
Well, the commodities are smaller in terms of how much, and it's like they're always within the larger works that are being created by her, so it's
uh-huh,
interesting.
Uh-huh.
They really are kind of minuscule in terms of the power of it. They kind of traverse through it, but like with all of these, I feel like the sculptures, the work that she's doing is much larger than
mm-hmm.
the
well, and also the commodities, the objects, are representational.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the sculptures are abstract.
Right.
So that's another kind of dialogue or dialectic that she's setting up repeatedly. And so you constantly go back and forth between this thing that's abstract that you want to kind of try to interpret,
mm-hmm.
make associations with, and then these things that are, you know, really at face value, they are what they are.
And we had talked, I think at one point, something had come up about these as being kind of elaborate. You could think about them as elaborate frames or...
Yeah, or displays.
But I'm thinking it actually is something a little different, which is the way that she's displaying these objects changes their meaning.
Uh-huh.
And
The commodities?
Well, yeah, the commodities. The way she's she changes their meaning by displaying them in different sorts of ways, uh-huh. and has you think about them more complexly because of that.
Absolutely.
And so that's what is kind of really fascinating about it. But if a person coming off the street, and just going back to what I was saying before, it's this idea of multiple meanings. You can look at one little part of it and go off on it. Uh-huh. But all of these artists are challenging you to look at the whole, the bigger picture, everything.
Yeah. That the parts are part of a whole,
right.
and you can't really separate them.
Right. And I think sometimes people might fixate on the things they recognize from everyday life
uh-huh.
in a museum environment, and that to see them in this new environment, I think is so that's kind of where the ready-made comes into.
Yeah.
But also,
well, and the ready-made is a you know Duchamp is a, right. is a really important inspiration mm-hmm. for Rachel. In part, thinking about the ready-made, mm-hmm. And if you think of her sculptures as elaborate displays for objects, mm-hmm. then it pushes the ready-made into a different realm.
Yeah.
You know that it's not just taking the urinal and putting it on the wall; it's creating a whole elaborate thing upon which to put these things. And that we talked about in Cindy, and it's also true in Pretty Discreet that there's a reference, or or in the case of Cindy, an inclusion of a wall mm-hmm. in the work. So again, it's thinking about what's the function of the wall when we think about art. It's usually the site upon which an artwork is viewed, right? Mm-hmm. We don't usually associate it with sculpture. Sculpture is usually away from the wall, independent of
right.
the wall. And so that's a, you know, that's a lot to talk about right there. But also in her titles, I think you think about Duchamp. Pretty Discreet seems to have the quality of a pun.
Right. And even the figure, which is named Big John Stud, is interesting because these are actually all studs
that are in the work.
To put it together, and he's kind of holding it together, or he could be slipping off.
He's slipping, or he's climbing, or you know.
He reminds me of the champion gladiators. They used to have those big obstacle courses. I don't know. It was an old.
Well, and all-star wrestling is a huge phenomenon.
Yeah.
And I'm afraid I don't follow it closely, but I think Big John Studd must be an actual, you know, athlete who has some amount of recognition because he has his own doll.
Right.
Well, the process of working with the artists to make their collection and context galleries was so much fun. In part because I don't know a better way than to spend the day in storage with an artist,
yeah.
just pulling things off the shelf and looking, and just it was amazing. But
how did she or the artists that you worked with look at things differently than maybe you would?
Well, the process was interesting because we sent them a bunch of materials, catalogs that we have of the collection, which are not, you know, all inclusive or comprehensive. We encouraged them to go to our website and really do research there. So by the time they came to the museum to go into storage, they already had a number of works they knew they wanted to see. Our sculpture storage is this really wonderful setup because, except for the very large scale things which have to be stored in another place, everything is in there and it's not crated.
Mm.
So we have shelves and shelves and shelves of objects. So we were there looking for certain things that they wanted to see, but they were also free to roam and look at, you know, anything that kind of struck them. So I would say that, you know, they came into it, especially Charles and Evan, with a number of kind of lesser-known artists on their list that they wanted to see.
Mm-hmm.
So that was kind of a starting place for them. There were periods of time they were interested in. Charles's work tends to be from the 50s on. Most everything in Evan's gallery is from the 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
Rachel's is a little more, there's more of a range, and she leaned towards some contemporary work,
mm-hmm.
which the others didn't so much.
Mm-hmm.
Although, you know, Gober, I guess, would be the most recent piece in here, so it's nothing super duper new. But I think just what I was really struck by was how I understood more about their practice
mm-hmm.
and the way they make things and the interests they have and preoccupations they have in sculpture
mm-hmm.
by the choices they made for their collection galleries. And I think it's wonderful to see that. I mean,
yeah.
let's, well, we'll start here. what we're looking at is the Daumier figures, or some of them are attributed to Daumier. We're not sure if Daumier actually made them or not. Little figures that are staring at a small John Chamberlain.
Yeah, I've never seen one so small.
Yeah, exactly. They almost feel like maquettes for the larger pieces,
really,
but I love this Chamberlain. It's a really interesting one with a lot of different lines, and the colors are really wonderful.
And they're all kind of just almost silhouettes. You know, not silhouettes, but they're just one color.
Right, so the bronze figures are all, that patina, that dark patina.
Right.
And they're all, they're society figures. So they're things like The Strolling Bourgeois, which is such a great title, The Poet, The Visitor, The Lover. I mean, they're all figures from 19th century France that Daumier is representing and also somehow satirically mocking, right?
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And they have wonderful expressions and stances.
Uh-huh.
And Rachel has very cleverly, but also in a very serious way, positioned them so that they're looking at the Chamberlain, right?
Right. So we're she's kind of replicating on a smaller scale what we just did, which was we were in front of works trying to figure them out, and now she's got
these guys trying to figure out this work that comes from the next century.
Right.
They're looking into the future, right?
Yeah. It's a very interesting statement in a way, because it's kind of, in some ways, putting parentheses around what's happening now.
Yeah.
People are looking at this work and trying to
and
think about...
And thinking of what happens later.
There's this person with the broom here, though, that seems to be looking away like, they just work here, they don't care.
Yeah, he's indifferent.
Yeah.
but also...
That's pretty funny.
But I think, and then you look at Rachel's work that's all about looking.
Right.
It's about how do we look? How do we experience art? What happens when we walk into a gallery? Is it on the wall? Is it in the floor? Is, what's the relationship between the different elements? The display critique that happens in her work is completely apparent in the way that she set up these objects.
And it's funny, because when I had first heard you talk about it being all about looking, and I kind of was like, huh, what's that mean, all about looking? Because I look all the time and I see what I see. but it really is. There's a constant framing and reframing in terms of her sculpture, it's sculpture, but it is doing something else. It is also, in some ways, steering our look even into the room and into other rooms in some interesting sorts of ways.
Well, in that way, the way... One thing, she's done a really beautiful thing here, really smart.
And so they place the objects
was completely their choice. Yeah. I mean, we worked together, mostly just because I wanted to hang around with them while they were doing it.
Yeah.
But we had some really great conversations. But we really gave them pretty much total freedom to choose the objects, to do the installation, to think about the design for the galleries. And we helped and made suggestions around design decisions, like platforms and pedestals and wall colors and labels and stuff like that. But Rachel's done this totally brilliant gesture where she's put this really lovely Louise Nevelson piece that we have called Standing Figure, which is from the 1950s. And we have a lot of Nevelson in the collection, who's an artist that I'm really interested in, and Rachel is quite interested in also. But this is one that doesn't, in fact, get shown as much as the others. The other ones are more typical of the work that people know of Nevelson. I have one in my collection in Context Gallery, which is one of the more architectural pieces. Again, the wooden forms put together. But this one is a figure, albeit an abstracted figure.
Yeah.
But it's totemic, and it's very vertical. And she's placed her work, two bathers, at the beginning of her gallery, entering from this end. And when you stand in front of this Nevelson, you see her two bathers, which is a black and white, very vertical, I think it's 8 feet tall, piece. And you really see the relationship her work has to Nevelson here. And it's just such a great view.
It's also interesting because we're also looking at the two-sided piece, if you remember what it's called.
The two bathers.
Yeah, the two bathers. And I'm actually seeing that black shape almost as a silhouette.
Absolutely.
And so there's a really interesting thing that starts to happen where...
Absolutely. And that was a very deliberate decision on her part. And it's a very poetic moment, but rooted in formalism, in shape and color or blackness. The other really kind of cool view is when you come in off the escalators... and you walk in and you see the Louise Bourgeois, great piece, Blind Leading the Blind, a wood structure of all these kind of legs, and two things happen. You know, you kind of, you the view, and this is very unusual, I've seen the piece installed just one other time at the Hirshhorn, but I've seen versions of it installed in different ways. And it's not typical to get this view initially, which is sort of through the legs, so to speak. Right. Like almost it becomes like a corridor.
Yeah.
It really suggests space, casts a really cool shadow. And then you see it with the Philip Guston painting.
Uh-huh.
And the forms in the Philip Guston,
right,
these leg-like things, these kind of long, mm-hmm. Spindly legs that fall over the brick wall, seem to be really reflected in the Bourgeois, and it's just, it's really nice.
Mm.
And then the Twombly with the Bob Gober is just, again, like, really wonderful juxtaposition. We've got three parts of an X, this really profound and great artwork by Robert Gober that's plaster and wood and hangs on the wall, and it's suggestive of a porcelain sink that's kind of gone awry in some way. And then we've got the little Twombly, which is painted, called Untitled Roma. It's from 1959, but it has the same white surface.
Yeah, it's been really interesting to look at collections in context, because you do see a sensibility that their work is grounded in, or at least something that they're drawn to as artists.
Yeah, but what? Tell me what comes to mind in terms of Rachel that you see
here. For some reason, I see humor and I see gender in this, and it's weird because I don't usually look at these works as necessarily funny, but if I look at them, they seem there seems to be a sense of humor, but there also seems to be a sense of
there's gravity at the same time.
It's gravity, but it's also kind of it's not sensitivity, but it's there's a softness that makes sense. I can't explain it.
Yeah.
Or a seriousness.
So absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, we were thinking with the Chamberlain and the Daumiers, it's so funny.
Yeah.
And at first you walk up and you just think, oh, that's so funny and clever. And of course the issues of scale are really clever. And
it works with your work in terms of display and how display conveys meaning and narrative. Yeah.
But it's also very serious.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's not a lighthearted gesture.
No.
It's very much about these very big issues about how art operates.
And I think that's an interesting, maybe an interesting thing for us to think about, which is that there is both humor and there's a kind of understanding of the seriousness, but it's not as if it's a giant crisis.
Yeah.
It's almost like an acceptance or resignation that you just deal with it.
Well, I think that humor, I mean, humor is an interesting thing,
because
humor often is, I don't want to say masking, but it certainly does kind of placate something more serious.
Uh-huh.
And so it can function in that way. Humor isn't always in a dismissive sense. You know, it isn't about... it's one way of tackling something.
Well, I also think it makes it easier to tackle bigger, harder things that are just painful. And so that's kind of, I would say, just talking about this work when we first kind of approaching it, which is, you know, thinking about how it might reflect what the times are
something
like, and
more
uncertainty.
Serious.
It is serious, but it is also a way of recognizing a certain amount of, I guess, fallibility, or a certain amount of ways to live with it.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe.
Well, then, in the context of this conversation about humor, then the Daumiers are a really interesting choice for that reason as well, because the satirical work of the 19th century is such an interesting history for her to at least quote here, because it is, I mean, it really, satire is used as a way to talk about things that are extremely difficult, and it's a social critique oftentimes. It's a way of saying, you know, this world is problematic, that there are, in the case of these Daumier figures, you know, that there are hierarchies that I want to acknowledge. There's a class system, there's a, you know, a bourgeois society, there's a viewing public versus, you know, say a working public or whatever, you might want to describe it as.
And I think it's really telling about her work. I think we started talking about those issues with her work. So they're mm-hmm. there, and they're in the materials, but these materials are ones that are connected to our own time period mm-hmm. And to the ways that people are working now. So
yeah. Let's just end by just at least mentioning the Anne Truitt, which is such a beautiful sculpture.
This is a beautiful sculpture.
And, you know, I think Rachel from the very beginning wanted this Anne Truitt. Oops, I set off the alarm.
Oh, I must have. Well, it's just because we didn't take it out the door. Oops, I guess we got caught.
So unfortunately, you can't go up and hug it, but it's just a gorgeous sculpture, and I know it was an early pick. And I think, you know, Rachel really is interested in women artists, particularly of earlier generations, who have, you know, varying amounts of recognition, but to really look very closely at their work and think about what kind of influence they've had, think about how their work might differ from their peers at the time, and Truitt's such a great minimalist who, in fact, has some very interesting ways of working that are different than, say, Judd. Much more hand quality to them. You can see the brush strokes actually on the surface of this piece.
See, that, I think that's what was that's fascinating to me, is that she's picked these works that, except for the Gussmaier, feel very quiet in a way to
uh-huh.
me. And then her work seems really extroverted.
Yeah.
So
maybe the Gussmaier was the way to like throw that off. You know, and at first I didn't want any two-dimensional work.
Right.
I had told the artist explicitly
to
choose sculpture because the whole intention was to really do an investigation of sculpture. But Rachel wanted to look at these two-dimensional pieces, and I realized that, of course, she uses two-dimensional pieces in her sculpture. In the duck's leg piece that we didn't talk about, there's a photograph.
Right.
In Two Bathers, there's the reproduction of the Cezanne, and then an image from advertising. So the juxtaposition between two-dimensional and three-dimensional is really an active part of her practice. So it made sense then for her to be able to do that in the gallery as well. Mm.